Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about episode 11 in our current series, The State versus Greg Lance. That episode is called Murder Clan, may I say, an outstanding name for the episode. And if you haven't heard it yet, it contains bombshells. Go back and listen. We'll be right here waiting for you when you are done. I'm Rebecca Lavoy, host of the True Crime Review podcast, Crime Writers On, and one of the audio editors for Undisclosed. And with us today are three people, the first of which is Rabia Chaudhry, New York Times bestselling author of Adnan's Story, lead reporter and lead mic dropper on this series. Hello, Rabia. It's great talking to you.
Hey, Rebecca, all the way from Berlin.
That's incredible. This is like very intercontinental, what's happening right now. It's very exciting for me.
It's amazing. I love it. Yeah.
Also with us is Washington, D.C.-based lawyer and super sleuth Susan Simpson, who blogs at The View from LL2. Hello, Susan.
Hello. And I am, in fact, taking a break finally from impeachment hearings today to join y'all.
We appreciate it. We know how much you enjoy this kind of news event. And finally with us is Linda Bousman. She's a retired judicial assistant, having worked for the state of Florida for 35 years. Linda worked for 5 years in the county clerk's office before taking a position as judicial assistant to the Honorable Martha C. Warner, a judge on the 4th District Court of Appeal in West Palm Beach, Florida. Linda is enjoying her current position as gardener and homemaker, as well as working to help free Greg Lance of his wrongful conviction. Hello, Linda. It's wonderful to meet you.
Hi, Rebecca. Nice to meet you as well.
Now, anyone who listened to this week's episode knows it contained a lot of information that was very important in this case. So I'm just going to give a quick synopsis to remind you of what we heard. Episode 11, Murder Clan, examines the prime suspects in the Kolesnikow murders, Sam and Peggy Horn. The Horns not only lived across the street from Victor and Alla, like Greg, they had bought owner-financed property from the Kolesnikows. And like Greg, and according to multiple witnesses who knew the Horns, they were being foreclosed upon for being behind in payments. Sam Horn was also cooking and dealing meth from his kitchen and was paranoid that Victor was going to turn him in for it. The Horns were known for having a violent criminal history that extended beyond Sam and Peggy. They were tied to a number of murders, including the murder of businessman Charles Hamlet, who they attempted to extort, the murder of Sanford Horn, Sam's brother, and the campus officer that Sam allegedly shot in the 1970s or 80s. Peggy had a long record of theft and bad checks, like her mother, Rose Redman, who was involved in both the Hamlet and Sanford Horn murders. While many other Horns, like Sam's nephew Mike, who left his dentures behind when he murdered a woman in 2010, they have long violent criminal histories as well. This episode also introduced us to multiple witnesses who have information tying the Horns to the Kolesnikow murders: Billy Cleghorn, Jackie Cleghorn, Paula Lackamore, and Lacey Harness. Billy and Paula came forward as early as 1999, giving statements to both the authorities and Greg's defense counsel about the information they had. Billy was at the Horn residence on the night of the murders and says Sam ran out from his house as the Kolesnikow's house was burning and told Billy to leave before the police arrived. Billy and Jackie both confirm that in the days after the murders, Peggy was geeking out, an expression we learned the meaning of in this episode, weeping and seemingly confessing to the crimes. Billy and Paula both assert that Samantha Horn, Sam and Peggy's daughter, admitted her parents killed the Kolesnikows. Finally, the episode ends with Lacey Harness, who was at the Horn residence all night and over the years has offered incrementally more information every time he's been spoken to. This time, when he spoke to Joyce and Linda, he told them he witnessed the Horn house reeking of gas, and the morning after the murders, he saw Sam burning their clothing, torching the door off of a safe he stole from the Kolesnikow property, and burning documents as he went through them looking for the deed to their property. All right, so I just want to say, I don't know if any of you have seen the show Justified, which was a long-running series on FX. When I was hearing about these Horns, all I kept hearing about were these, like, Dixie criminal families that you see in shows like Justified. Like, what incredible characters these people were, but also, why weren't they in the frame, period? Rabia, I know that's a big question and we have other things to talk about, but, like, can we just get to that first? Because that seems to be the one the most listeners have. I have it too. What happened here?
You mean how did they evade police?
Yes, with all of these people who can corroborate that they were involved, and with so many ties that are stronger between them and the Kolesnik house, way stronger than the ties between Greg and the crime.
Well, that'll come in 2 weeks. But I will say this. By the time Billy Cleghorn and Paula Lackmore gave statements to the police, it was 1999. It was a year later. Greg had been in prison for about 7 or 8 months at that point. The authorities were like deeply invested in convicting Greg by that point. That's not to say that Sam wasn't on their radar much earlier. He actually was. And we are going to talk about that in the finale episode. Why they didn't go after him is a question that I'm always going to wonder about. And I also about even in this episode comes to the other crimes he's connected to. I don't know. Susan has her theory about it, and we can talk about that. But we're going to talk about kind of what is the first inclination the police had tying Sam to this. And it was much earlier than Billy coming forward. So we're going to explore in the last episode.
Thoughts, Susan?
I wouldn't say it's a theory so much as just a guess. But the part of Paula's story, we talked to her, that stuck out to me the most was her story about the pipe bomb, car bomb, whatever it was. And to me, it shows that the police did have close tabs on that family. They were involved in monitoring or you know, in some way or another, the police were involved with that family. And they got intel they found credible enough that they had to move and risk that intel to try and protect Paula. I wonder if they had that kind of eyes on side the Horn operation, that they trust that well, if that could be why they got off the Horn trail. If this source, whatever it was, that they apparently take so seriously that they'll try and stop a murder based on it. If the source is saying it wasn't them, here's how I know it, and they believe the source, that could explain why the Horns got shut down.
Right. So, Linda, I want to talk about your involvement in this case. You know, we heard from you in an earlier episode, but I'd like to know what your involvement has actually looked like over the last 17 years. What kind of work have you been doing, research? I'd love to hear just a little bit about your role here.
Well, first, let me say that when I came into this thing, I was completely naive as to what is involved in trying to overturn a wrongful conviction. I had no idea how hard it was to get anyone to listen to you. So my involvement has been chasing records. Joyce and I have driven multiple country roads trying to find witnesses just time after time. My husband and I like to vacation in the Smoky Mountains. So every time we're going to take a vacation up there, we would go by through Cookeville, Tennessee, either going up that way or coming back, just so Joyce and I could go try to chase down another witness or try to talk to someone else. And it's just been, it's been years of just, I don't know about you guys, but when you're working on one of these cases, it just seems that you live, eat, and breathe the case until, you know, through the whole thing. And I know that there were nights when I would just lie in bed at night and say to myself, if I don't find a way to help this young man, he's going to die there. He had lost so much between losing the construction company, the trailer park, his wife, never seeing his child born, his family, everything. It was just, it was eating on me day after day after day. So over the years, I've just been, mostly a lot of it has been being a friend to Joyce when something comes up. But I'll tell you, she is relentless. She is fearless. She talks to everybody. She never gives up. And you know, that's probably a point that I personally would like to make known to the listeners, anyone who's out there listening to Undisclosed, that don't give up.
Okay, look, I'm not trying to brag, but I am one of those people who, when I give a gift, I like to give something meaningful and thoughtful. Because if I'm giving something to somebody I love and care about, I want them to know I put some time and effort into it. I want to find something special and unique. And that's why I love the website Uncommon Goods. Uncommon Goods has some of the most unique, beautiful items like I've ever seen. I mean, stuff for your home, for your office, great gifts for kids, holiday gifts, you name it. I recently bought a coloring tablecloth that's like a tablecloth we put and we eat on it, and it has the map of the United States with like every state's, like, you know, flower and animal and, you know, the state capital. And it's just a great, fun way for kids to learn. And it's an activity we do together. So that's something that I've bought for my kids. And I recently got for a baby shower the Sweet Dreams Tap Nightlight. Adorable. It's a little wooden cloud and a little wooden star. And you hang them on the wall. And they're both nightlights. I mean, I've never seen gifts like this. I also love their jewelry collection. They have beautiful, unique pieces that you can get like in any price range that, you know, works for you. The Uncommon Goods team scours the globe looking for the most unique, creative things they can find. These are things you cannot find anywhere else. I'm just telling you, I'm like addicted to this website, right? And if that's not enough, Uncommon Goods donates $1 for every purchase that you make, and it's given more than $2 million to nonprofit organizations like RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, and the IRC, the International Rescue Committee. They support good causes like paid family leave, a fair living wage. They do not sell products made with fur, feathers, or leather, and they support small businesses and local artists. I mean, what is there not to love? Uncommon Goods wants to help you discover your new favorite thing, so they're offering our listeners an exclusive deal on your first purchase. Go to uncommongoods.com/undisclosed and get $5 off your first purchase. That's uncommongoods.com/undisclosed to receive $5 off on your first purchase.
Can we talk about the horns just as a, you know, I mentioned them earlier and I don't mean to make light of it, but it is almost like you can't make them up. I mean, we have somebody in the podcast who calls them a family of killers. That was their reputation. It seemed to be widely known. Some of the crimes that, you know, this family is associated with, they sound made up. They just do. And some of them are incredibly serious. And yet they still sort of had like a presence in this community and people knew who they were and were friends with them and stayed at their house and married and dated and out of their family. Many of them ended up in prison, but Sam, who's a big part of the focus of this episode, didn't. Why did he not end up in prison along with so many other members of his family?
I'd love to hear what Linda thinks about that. She's talked to, because Linda, I know you've talked to a lot more people who've known Sam over the years.
Well, somebody, my personal opinion is, for whatever it's worth, somebody up there had something on Sam, or Sam had something on someone else. There was, or they were all afraid of him. And I've heard that he, you know, if he put a gun in Jackie Claghorn's mouth or Billy Clay, you know, he just was a mean person. And, you know, I understand that, you know, they're afraid of him up there. They all were. But from the statements that I've also read, I understand that Peggy is, just can be just as mean. So, and everything that we've been told by witnesses indicates that Peggy is the one who did the actual shooting.
Hmm. Yeah, I thought that story about her, you know, being high and sort of having these like long delusional monologues, and in them were included details about carrying around a gun with a flashlight on it, right? I know I heard that in the episode, completely like a detail that she wouldn't necessarily have known, right? Would that have been a detail that she would have known or not if she hadn't actually experienced it? I mean, maybe she could have read it or something.
At the time, here's the thing. Like, if you look at the timeline, what Billy and Jackie and Rachel Claghorn, all the people who were at that house, and Lacey Harness, were at the house at the time that Peggy was freaking out. This is like in the few days right after the murder. The police have not found the weapon yet. So if she really did say that, and they really do know she said that, then yes, she's identifying the weapon that was found like a month later. However, by the time they reported it to law enforcement, a year had gone by. So I don't know for sure if they actually heard Peggy say that from her own mouth. And if she did, then she definitely had some knowledge of the murder weapon. Or if a year later they had by then read it in the newspaper, because I think eventually it did, unless I'm misremembering. But I think Linda, when they found the murder weapon after that, there were some news reports that talked about the murder weapon at some point having a flashlight on it. Otherwise, it would be a detail only
right.
The killer would know.
Right. I think you're correct. Yeah.
So this kind of, it's not a side story because it's basically in the podcast, I think, to just sort of establish patterns and characters of this family in the landscape of this community and of this story. The story about Charles Hamlet's death in this motel and this shakedown. Was his death a murder, or was this a shakedown and it was supposed to be a sex thing and he had a heart attack? Like, do we know what actually happened to him?
Negative.
We don't know?
I thought that he died. I thought he had a heart attack.
Well,
that's the way I understood it. He died before the whole ordeal got completed.
But if he was, like, drugged or something, it'd still be a murder. I mean, it's I'd say it's pretty unclear what exactly went down.
So the newspaper reported it as that he died of a heart attack. But look, I don't know who did his autopsy, but if it was Harlan, the guy from our last episode,
yeah,
this guy could have been killed with a gunshot wound. We don't even know. But I mean, look, he was. I mean, what they did do, they did intentionally, from what we've heard from other witnesses, from people who knew them or had heard the story, they did intentionally liquor him up and give him drugs, and that could have caused, you know, him to die. I mean, it could have been an overdose. I just don't know. I don't really trust the newspaper report. We don't have an autopsy report. But at the end of the day, like, all the charges were dropped. Like, nothing happened to anybody. And I thought that was kind of crazy.
I was so curious about the lawsuit, you know, and all I kept thinking about was, like, the poor judge who had to listen to this thing and, like, all of these salacious details and then make a decision. It was like, can you imagine, like, you're coming to work and you're, like, thinking you're going to be helping settle a reasonable dispute between parties, and then this is what you confront in your courtroom, are these people with this story? It's bananas.
Well, I feel like Linda probably has seen a lot of crazy stories in her time.
Yeah, but this pretty much tops it. After all, even all the years in the courts, I have not seen anything like this.
So Sam Horn's brother was murdered. Was Sam actually involved in that murder? Like, what is the story there?
You know, I mean, like, so I'll be honest. When I first got involved in this case, and, you know, I'm just, like, looking at, you know, the Klusnikow stuff. And then, but I'm hearing from Joyce and Linda and others, like, oh, but then there's this other case with this guy who died in a hotel. And then Sam's brother was killed by his mother-in-law. I was just like, what the heck? I mean, it was just, all of it's so crazy, no matter what actually happened. I don't know if, I mean, like, it's weird. Rose Redmond, I mean, she doesn't really have a history of violence necessarily, although she did have an involvement definitely in Charles Hamlet's murder, but her involvement was apparently to kind of lure him into the whole thing. But other than that, like, her criminal history is, like, kind of like her daughter, which is, like, writing bad checks and a lot of theft, things like that. So I don't know. And she's always maintained her innocence, apparently. Even in her, like, kind of post-conviction stuff, she's like, I'm innocent. And Sam is not implicated in any way other than the fact that, like, the guy who, Peavy, in his interrogation, and he's so clearly, like, kind of, like, the poor guy is so disturbed in his interrogation. He does mention Sam's name a couple of times. And then, like, once he corrects himself and says, no, not Sam, Andy. I mean, Andy, like, you know, my mother's husband or aunt's husband. He called her his mother. But I will say this, the whole thing made me really sad, because what was seemed pretty clear was that this guy Pee-wee was really mentally unwell. And it did seem clear that Rose, who raised him like a mother, did egg him on to, like, kill this guy, you know. And even in her protestations where she says she's innocent, she still admits that she knew that, you know, Pee-wee was having issues. And she said to him, well, she said he had money issues. And she's like, if you need money, well, then this guy has some money. Like, she still did kind of egg him on to his crime. So I don't know. Not a good person.
She seemed to be, like, a bad actor, like, in the way that, and I'm sorry I keep using Justified as the comparison. It took place in a whole different state, and it's different. But, like, she's like the Margot Martindale character, Mags, where she's sort of, like, is the puppet master, and, like, people are kind of, like, doing, that's how it sounded, and that's what it reminded me of when I was listening to this episode. And then, of course, we hear all the stuff, too, about Peggy, and it's like, what is happening in this family? Like, I mean, I really, like, I wish I could go back in time and just be in a fly on the wall and just sort of see what the discourse is like with these people, like, on a Saturday afternoon. Are they constantly scheming and planning things? Is this their whole life?
Meth is the answer you're looking for.
Well, the answer is yes.
Meth.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's true. there does seem to be a lot of that. And I really did love Paula's description of that it wasn't like Breaking Bad scientific meth. It was, you know, kitchen sink, kitchen stove, just constantly, like, it was really something to imagine. And good for her for, you know, getting her life together somewhat. I mean, it sounds like she's in a much better situation now. So let's talk about the Cleghorns. They have also a pretty robust criminal history. So why should we believe them? I mean, one of the things that stuck out to me is that Billy showed up at the Horns' house at 4 a.m. That's a detail that I kind of circled when I was reproducing the episode. Like, why would you show up at somebody's house at this precise time? Another house was burning down. What's the deal with them?
Can I just say also, I love that the names, like, they remind me so much of like the Starks and the Karstarks.
100%. At some point, they may have, you know, this is like a thing that I know from Jason Moon, host of Bear Brook, who's from Alabama. And in the tiny community where he grew up, there's a lot of that where families have like, you know, over generations, like slightly, there's a shared kind of big tree. And then over time, there's sort of variations in names, and you see it in town names and you see it in family names. Like the town he's from, the town next door, which is named after a guy spelled backwards. And then a family took that backwards name and that became their name. So I don't know if that's specific to Alabama, but that's what this story reminded me of, is that, like, you know, like clan situation that he described. So anyway, the Cleghorns, please tell me about these people and why we should believe them when they also have kind of a dodgy background.
I want Susan to describe meeting Billy.
Maybe I'm the only one who thought that was a crazy meeting.
Oh, it was crazy. Not Billy, actually. He was remarkably
sober,
normal-ish. Yeah. Just the whole setup of the jail there. I'm like, anyone could have done anything in that jail they wanted to.
I could have brought weapons in.
We could have brought anything. I could have gotten like at least 10 kilos of coke in there. No problem. Zero problem.
They didn't even look at our ID. I couldn't believe, I just showed up. I had emailed.
Yeah. I don't place much weight on this necessarily because who knows, but in terms of just his demeanor and interacting with him, Billy Cleghorn seemed credible. I don't mean that since I believe everything he said, but he comes across in a very credible way. He seems like a fairly sincere kind of person when he's talked to us. I definitely did not get a sense that he was hiding some kind of dark secret about all this.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that I don't make that to say like, oh, he's definitely credible. But like in terms of how he comes across, yeah, he seems like he was fairly straightforward with us.
Mm. And you were allowed to record him.
Yes.
Well,
we could have done anything. Like if we could have fit him into a bag, we could have walked out with him.
At first, are we safe? There's like nobody here watching. Like it was just crazy. But I will say this about Billy and his brother Jackie, and they both do have histories. And we heard about one of, you know, how Jackie and Sam, you know, who go back forever. They're best friends from like, you know, since they were kids. Did that heist at that hardware store that they got caught in. So, you know, Jackie was involved in this stuff too. But Billy and Jackie, you know, most of their criminal records are this. It is burglaries. It's thefts. Possession, you know, drug possession. I didn't see any kind of violent offenses. I'm not saying that, you know, but the other thing is Billy and Jack, they've been consistent over the years. Their story really hasn't changed. And there was a time when Billy could have gotten something out of it. Maybe he thought he could have, he was hoping he would have, but that's not true today. There's really no reason for him to, you know, there's just nothing. He can't get anything out of this for talking to us, for standing by a story. I mean, he could just be like, look, I'm sick of this shit. Leave me alone.
His overall feelings about the case seem like, I'd say the predominant emotion is just confusion. He's like, yeah, that shit happened. I don't really get how things ended up the way they did.
He's been around Greg. He's just like, I remember he's called him a church boy when we were talking to him. He's like, what the heck? How did Greg get caught in this?
Do you have thoughts about the Cleghorns, Linda?
I think that Jackie and Billy have both tried to do the right thing from the beginning. They really have. I think they both have been very helpful in this case.
And I'm curious to know, like, what, being devil's advocate, like, is there something in it for them to help at this point? I mean, do they have a vendetta against the Horns, or are they legitimately just like, it doesn't serve me to not help, so I'm going to? Do you know what's kind of driving them to be helpful, to talk to the undisclosed team, for instance?
No, I think they just want to do what's right at this point. And like Robbie said, they don't have a history of violence. I think they're just trying to make it right.
I'm not even sure that's the right way to describe Billy, at least. It's not like he's actively trying to make something right. It's just like he knows something and he doesn't give a shit about telling people about it. So if you ask.
Look, yeah. The other thing is, there's a couple of things. Number one, Sam's dead, and that did come up in the episode. We'll talk about that in the finale, about how that went down. But, you know, Billy was talking even before Sam died. But the other thing is, I know with Jackie and some others I've met too, you know, Joyce has approached them over and over again over the years. And Paula said this to us when Susan and I spoke to her. Paula said, you know, at this point, she's like, it's just about, She's like, you know, the pain she sees, because Paul is like, you know, we don't want to deal with this stuff anymore. Like, we said what we said, we've given our statements, but just they feel Joyce's pain, the pain of a mother who's like trying to get justice for her son. And so they're willing to help. I've also been told that Jackie is like, you know, has become a Christian. And so he really does want to do the right thing and help. And I spoke, I mean, he doesn't appear in the episode, but we have spoken a couple of times and he stands by what he said.
We get it. Ordering online flowers sucks. Crazy expensive, sad-looking flowers that die in 2 days, hard pass. But the Bouqs, total game changer. Bouqs, that's short for bouquets, are sustainably grown and cut fresh from the world's finest eco-friendly farms, even farms in the size of volcanoes. They're sourced directly, so your flowers stay fresher longer. Can't tell you how many times I've given flowers as gifts, only to have them die after a few days. And it's been even worse when I've ordered flowers online, only to find them arrive already on death's door. But with the Bouqs company, I ordered my flowers from my wife 2 weeks ago, and they're still beautiful and fresh as a daisy. The Bouqs company delivers beautiful, farm-fresh, sustainably grown flowers, plants, and awesome gifts. They're perfect for birthdays, anniversaries, or just because. The Bouqs offers customizable subscription services as well, and their flowers come from eco-friendly farms who pay workers higher on average and have high standards for quality and freshness. Grounded in transparency, responsibility, and simplicity, the Bouqs company creates genuine moments of emotional connection for their Bouqs fam and builds meaningful relationships with like-minded farmers and florists who they empower to thrive and eliminate unnecessary waste along the way. Simply put, there's no better way to give thanks than with a Bouq. And now, listeners, you can get 25% off your order from the Bouqs company with code undisclosed. You know, good things come in flower packages. Celebrate life's moments with farm-fresh Bouqs. To get 25% off your first Bouq order, go to bouqs.com/undisclosed to get 25% off your first order with code undisclosed.
So many of the witnesses in this part of the story admit that they were high on meth all the time at this period in time. So, you know, again, playing devil's advocate, why should we believe them? Are they reliable? And the ones that came forward a year or so afterward, why should we believe they were reliable then? What do you guys think?
It's definitely, you have that's to absolutely consider it. You have, like, that's a solid fact you have to consider. Like, yeah. Maybe. Like, it's, and it also, it's not just a matter of, like, if they're lying or not. It does affect their perception of reality. So that's another factor that you can't ever get away from.
There's a part of Paula's interview that I mean, we spoke to her for quite a while that I didn't include in this that I wanted to, but I know, Rebecca, you're going to murder me because I already had like 50 clips in here.
47. That's okay. But one of them was accidentally a repeat. So it ended up being 46 in the end.
Well, I mean, so much of the conversations were so interesting, but there's a part of Paula's conversation where she describes, like, you know, the experience of being on meth, and depending on how the meth is made, like, you can adjust the meth making to get different results. So she was saying that, you know, she's like, yeah, meth will, I mean, like, it makes you geek out, but also it sometimes creates like this intense focus where you remember something and you can just never forget it. Like, you just are, you, that moment just does, it just sticks with you and sticks with you. And it, so, because I think I asked her that question or somehow came up, like, how can we know your memories are reliable? And she's like, well, you know, in that experience, there is this moment or this whatever, where whatever you're experiencing just sticks with you. And like that reality, like, you don't forget. And I don't know, but definitely, yeah. I mean,
I'll tell you, I found the most credible anecdote in the episode that came from Paula. It was just so specific that, like, it made no sense except that it totally did, which was when she talked about why she freaked out on Samantha, because Samantha had too much jewelry on, a ring on every finger and too many bracelets on. And that freaked. I can imagine, like, if you're in a state where you're kind of crawling out of your own skin, like, that would, how that could be a trigger in a weird way. But it's so specific that it did seem to me like that particular moment and detail was burned in her mind. And I believe that was when Samantha, like, started spilling her guts, right?
Yeah. When Paula started geeking.
Samantha's high too.
Yeah. Everybody's high all the time. So, question, you got a tipster who called in response to your asking if anybody worked in that campus security job in that period of time. He ended up giving you a different bit of information by giving you alternative suspects for the crime. Can you just address why you asked me to disguise his voice on that phone message?
Yeah, I mean, when I actually spoke to him the next day after getting his tip in depth, he was like, I don't want to tell you my name. But he gave me enough identifying information. I figured out who it was. But he's like, I'm straight up scared. And he's not the only one to say this. I mean, a number of people have expressed that they're scared, and not everybody's scared of the same thing. Some folks are scared of the police, and some folks are scared of the Horn family, which is still around, by the way. I mean, like, you know, there's still members of the Horn family living there. And so I didn't dig too deep about what his concerns were, but I certainly didn't want to put him in any kind of danger. And there'll be a witness we're going to talk about in the finale also, who we're going to create a alias for, because the same kind of issue. He's scared, you know. And it kind of reminded me of the Keith thing. I don't know if you remember Keith telling his wife, like, waking up in the middle of the night being really scared. And Greg wasn't around at the time, so we know he wasn't scared of Greg. Greg was in Arizona when he was having these night terrors and driving around, and he was telling Kay that they're going to come, they're going to burn down the house while we're in it, they're going to kill me. And I've always just wondered, like, who was he scared of? Was he scared of the police, or was he scared of the Horns? Like,
did he know the Horns?
I don't know if he did, but I don't think he did at all. I don't think any of Greg's world never crossed paths with the Horns. Like, these two
so interesting.
Careful, yeah. People know each other at all. But what I'm wondering is, did the police tell him? Like, what did the police tell Keith to make him that scared? Because the police are the only people who had to have said something to him. That's the only people he was speaking to make him that scared that somebody was going to kill him. Did the police say, look, you know, whoever did this is going to come after you? Like, I've never been able to figure that part out. Like, who is Keith scared of and who made him scared? I mean, like, it has to be the police. So what did the police tell him? I wish you could talk to him today to ask.
Well, there's a production detail that I just wanted to tell you that I didn't get to tell you when we were communicating about the episode. In disguising your tipster's voice, I tried out a bunch of different filters and I ended up sending you like three versions. And I did some other modifications so it wouldn't be able to be like reverse engineered and all that. But I did discover in my audio editing software that there is a filter for disguising voices called Angry Chipmunk. And I'm really...
Wait, I want to hear it.
I'm really hoping. Maybe Hannah, who edits this episode, because we use the same kind of software, maybe she could
do a little Angry Chipmunk. Try it out. I'm really hoping at some point in the future to get to use that Angry Chipmunk filter for you guys.
So you might have caught in this week's addendum episode that I happen to be all the way in Berlin, Germany, and I'm here for a conference for this week. And when I packed, look, I brought my toiletries, I brought the shoes I want, I brought all the warm items I need, and I brought my perfect snack bars. I am not kidding. It was one of the first things I packed in my purse before I left the house. I need those bars. If you haven't heard of Perfect Snacks and you're looking to freshen up your game, well, don't look any further. Perfect Snacks is a line of fresh, from-the-fridge protein bars that are made with freshly ground nut butter. They have up to 17 grams of whole food protein and 20 superfoods, and it's all combined to create a delicious cookie dough-like texture that is as nutritious as it is yummy. They have delicious flavors like dark chocolate peanut butter, almond butter, my favorite coconut peanut butter, so you don't have to sacrifice taste for health. Now, the thing is, these snacks are supposed to be refrigerated. However, they can stay fresh for up to 1 week out of the fridge. That's why I brought my snacks along. So they're perfect to take on the go, wherever you need a snack, and to help avoid any meltdowns. Now, those of you who travel a lot like me know that something's going on in airports, and nowadays there's a lot of delays. Well, that's where I knew I'd get stuck somewhere in my trip. And I did as always, but I had my perfect snacks and I didn't have to worry about finding a place to eat. I mean, like, they hit the spot, all that protein, all that goodness. And that's because they make you feel good, not just because they're delicious, but because they're non-GMO project verified, gluten-free, soy-free, they are kosher, low GI, and they are made in the USA. Look, right now, Perfect Bar is offering you 15% off your online order, so you have to check it out. Just go to perfectbar.com/undisclosed, shop their refrigerated snacks at perfectbar.com/undisclosed today to get 15% off your order. Make your day a little more perfect at perfectbar.com/undisclosed.
Well, I want to talk about Lacey, speaking of voices, because listeners should know his also needed some processing, not to disguise it, but to make it something you could hear, because he has the lowest, slowest human voice I've ever heard. I actually got in touch with Robbie and said, is this tape slowed down? Did something happen to this recording? And no, that's just his manner of speaking. So actually, I didn't raise his tone or anything, but I sped up the pace of his words so that it would be audible in the episode. But he's an interesting character. He was actually at the Horns' house the night of the murders. He has a very interesting story about the Horns both showering in the middle of the night and him remembering lying on the couch and the water dripping on him from being woken up and someone just getting out of the shower. He tells the story about burning clothes behind the house the next day and about breaking into this safe. And yet, at the end of the episode, you hint that you think he may have been involved. Can you talk about that, Rabia?
I mentioned it in the episode how, you know, I tried hard to find like Lacey and talk to him myself. Joyce and I went to a lot of homes. I made a lot of calls, got chased by a bunch of dogs. And I just wasn't able to. And I obviously had to come home. So, you know, Linda and Joyce got to speak to him. And so Linda, you know, in that recording, I think we hear her voice a couple of times.
A little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Linda, was this the first time you had ever spoken to Lacey? I know Joyce has spoken to him before, but I wasn't sure if you had spoken to him before.
That was my first time.
Yeah. And I also wanted to ask you, he does speak very slow. Is that just like his man, or was he like drunk or something? Had he been drinking or something?
No, that's just the way he is. It in a very low voice, mumbled kind of.
Yeah.
Not definite pronunciation. So,
well, good on you guys for getting the mic close enough to pick that up, because that is not easy. You obviously have a lot of experience talking to people on tape, because it would have been really easy for someone to have that conversation and then for me to get the tape and be like, yeah, no, can't use it. So you guys are doing a really good job capturing audio when you're out there having these conversations.
Yes, but you haven't heard everything that we sent, Rabia.
That's true.
So, one of them, we got back and she said, that is the most chaotic audio I've ever heard.
Well, I did say that Paula's barking dog was the real star of this episode. Let's be real.
We tried everything, man. That dog, he was a
dog.
He was fighting for justice, that dog was. He wanted you to get to the truth.
I was fighting my allergies, right? So anyway. Look, here's the thing. Lacey's story has changed over the years. He's been talked to a number of times, and every time he adds a little bit more detail. But this is the first time he's added this detail of what he saw the next morning. He's never said that before in his statements, that he, with his own eyes, saw, to me, that's direct evidence. He saw evidence that Sam and Peggy had in their possession stuff that belonged to the Klusnikows. That's safe, right? And he describes, in his conversation, he talks about this for a while. There's a lot of stuff he has to say about the safe that we haven't included in the episode. And I don't think he's making it up. And he's very detailed about it. And to me, so that means, you know, number one, he absolutely was there that night. He says he was there that night. There's no disputing that. Could they have done everything they said they did, or everything we think they did, without him having any inclination and just sleeping through it? I don't believe it. And Samantha also, in one of her, you know, had said at one point that she saw her parents and Lacey returning from the house. I don't know if that necessarily means that Lacey had anything to do with directly like shooting or, you know, but he might have been involved in moving their stuff, because because Peggy just couldn't help herself. She was a total kleptomaniac. She could not help herself. She had to bring back stuff from their house. And we've heard different reports. We've heard that she stole some Russian religious icons, that she stole a bunch from their house, so she just couldn't help herself. And so they brought back a bunch of stuff and she hid it.
I guess in that, when you're saying that, what you're implying then is if they'd committed the murders, then ransacked the house and then later burned it down is kind of what you're like going for there. Because they didn't just like burn it down and steal stuff as it was burning, right?
I don't think at this point, I don't think it's very likely that all of it happened in the same, like around 3 a.m. I think they could have easily killed them earlier and then, you know, taking their time to move what they want, search for what they want. I mean, there's that safe. And by the way, for this addendum, the title image for folks to check out on our website or wherever you can see it, title image is going to be a picture of the safe from the house that's wide open. And people don't keep their safes like that. So somebody was in that safe before the house was set on fire.
So is your thinking that the Klusnikows perhaps had two safes, They were able to open one of them in the house. They went through it, and what they were looking for wasn't there. They weren't able to open the other one in the house, so they figured we'll bring it home and deal with it later. And then they burn the house down. Is that kind of like the idea? And that's why that would explain the whole two safe situation?
Yeah, if indeed there was another safe, that's the only explanation, that there was a second one. They couldn't open a bigger one, a heavier one, one that had, I mean, the way Lacey described it, he said that it was like one of the real heavy safes with like crossbars and this and that. And it took Sam, Linda, how long did he say? It took Sam like an hour, hour and a half to like blowtorch it, the door off of it.
Hour and a half. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but the safe that we see in the picture doesn't seem to be as robust a safe. So maybe that was something. And remember, earlier in the episode, we talked about how Sam was cracking a safe in the hardware store. I mean, this man could crack safes. So, you know, he might have been able just to crack that safe in their house without having to move it.
What do you think? You're the one who actually met Lacey, Linda. Do you think that Rabia's theory holds water? Do you have an opinion about that?
You know, it's hard to know for sure because everybody has such a history. Everyone in this case is criminals, so you never know. But I have not seen anything yet that indicates that either Lacey or Samantha have a history of violence. But, you know, I may not have everything either. So, and everything that Joyce and I have been told is that Peggy did the shooting and Sam did the burning. So, you know, it may be that Samantha and Lacey had a part in this, but I think it was a minimal part. I don't think they were part of, you know, the worst of it. But they were still there.
Yeah.
So.
And Samantha was 17 or 16. She was a child. And, you know, I just think Lacey probably, because he keeps adding to what he's telling you, I feel like there's more that he could add as well. I think he was more involved than he's telling us, but maybe not completely, responsible for their deaths.
I just don't see any history of violence with him. And he was, you know, really kind to talk to us and very, very concerned about Greg having spent all these years in prison for something he didn't do.
Right. Well, there is something that happens after a long period of time. You know, I've written a book about a case like this where 20 plus years later, the high stakes of keeping a secret no longer exist, or they're just not worth it. And people feel a lot of relief when they unburden themselves, even if it implicates them, you know, either as a conspirator or whatever. Like, it feels at some point they don't realize they've been carrying it until they're asked the question. So maybe that's what's going on.
He's really trying. Right now he is taking care of his two children by himself, taking care of his mother. And I think Lacey's trying to do the right thing. At least I'm hopeful that that's where this is going.
I will say this, that, you know, when Joyce would go and speak to or try to speak to talk to witnesses, you know, the purpose was for her to get them to then talk to me, right, on the record, if I wasn't able to connect with them directly. And so Lacey did originally agree to speak to me. And then when they went back, he just wouldn't. He just dodged them. So I don't know if he got spooked or what happened, but what I have heard from some sources is that a lot of folks connected to this case are listening to this series.
Yeah. He'll either definitely want to talk to you now or definitely not want to talk to you now after hearing the episode. You know, you're going to get one of those two reactions. You're either going to get a never, 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 or you're going to get a, hey, I want to dispute that implication. You know what I mean? So, you know, you'll see. I guess we'll all find out if he reaches out. We have a couple listener questions that I'd love to include. One of them is from Bree Turner, who says, I haven't quite finished this week's episode, but in listening, a thought crossed my mind. Sam Horn was so concerned about the police blaming it on him. Was it ever thought by anyone that maybe someone else could have killed Victor and his wife, and then Sam Horn set the house ablaze when he was geeking, because I guess we all use that word now, because he was trying to cover up the murders, not because he killed them, but because he was paranoid the police would pin the murders on him, so he set the house ablaze. That's kind of what you guys were just implying, saying that it could have been Peggy.
No, but like someone totally random. I love the idea. Like some third party. Like we don't even like the Russian, I don't know. Like goes and shoots them. And then Sam Horn's there and hears this and he's like, oh man, I'm gonna go down for that. Then I'm gonna destroy the evidence for this guy who didn't clean up very well.
Or if they wanted to rob the house, you know, that would have been.
But... Oh, that too. No, that's what it was actually.
You mentioned the Russian icons. Do we know what happened to those? Because those can be collectible. They can be valuable. Is that something that is that we know to be true, that she stole those?
What would be amazing is if, because we know where Peggy and Samantha are. If like they have them up in their living room or something right now, who knows? We have no idea where those things are.
Pawn shop. Check the pawn shops in the area. That would be my recommendation.
No, I don't think she stole items to pawn. She liked to collect stuff. And we heard this from one of Jenny, actually, Jenny Harness, who was also there that one time that I think Linda spoke, Lacey's sister mentioned that she just liked to collect all kinds of weird things. So
We have a question that I can answer. Alice says she very much enjoyed the I told you so in Rabia's voice when asking whether people want to send Greg letters. That's actually the same tape you've been hearing all season, Alice. You're just interpreting it as an I told you so this time around. And I don't blame you for that because there was quite a mic drop right before those credits. And Audrey says that, you know, she says nothing surprises her anymore. And I'm assuming a lot of it has to do, I think, with some of her personal experience, but also listening to your podcast. The more cases I read about or listen to, I have no faith in any conviction. I don't think there is any such thing as justice. I'd love the three of you to respond to that. You know, at this point, you know, Linda, with the work you've done in this case, and Susan and Rabia with all the investigations you've done, do you have faith in and think there's any such thing as justice? I'm going to start with you, Linda. What do you think?
I think there's room for reform. There's a lot of room for reform. I worked on, I guess, what you would call the pretty side of the justice system. All the cases that came to the court were pretty much tied up in a bow and, you know, ready for judges to look at and, you know, attorneys to do memos on and, you know, whatever. But I had no idea what went on the ugly side of the system about, you know, evidence being withheld and prosecutors in, you know, the misconduct that comes along with some of this. So I just don't know. I think maybe it just depends on the people involved, but I have really seen a side of the justice system through working on Greg's case that's pretty disappointing.
What do you think, Susan?
I mean, if there wasn't room for justice, we wouldn't be doing this. I wouldn't be. It was just a hopeless situation. And it's not hopeless. Like we have in America, we do have a flawed but existing justice system. I mean, I think part of why I believe so strongly in wrongful convictions is making people care about these cases. And if you want to believe like most things are great, even then, making people care about the edge cases is hugely important so that as a general society, we don't get numb to it or uncaring. There are countries out there where wrongful convictions wouldn't really get in the radar because they know, as a matter of fact, that that's just how it works. Yeah. Mass arrests for things people didn't do or just like everyday life. And there it would be hard to get a wrongful conviction movement going because well, there's no faith in any of the convictions. And I think keeping the focus on like every case must matter, every case must be right, has value to the system as a whole.
What do you think, Rabia?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that in the system, like if you look at all the different players, I actually believe that even if one of them does their job right, like you can get justice, you know? I mean, when I think about Adnan's case, I think about like, if just one of them, just the cops or just the prosecutors or just Christina Gutierrez, if just one of them had done their job right, it would have worked out, right? Like I feel like that about, and that's not true for every case, but no, I do think, and I think for the most part, there are great prosecutors and there are great cops and there are good judges. And in many cases, you are getting the right person for the crime. I mean, but, you know, where the holes exist, they're big and they're deep. But, you know, like Susan said, if we didn't think there could be some course correction, we wouldn't be doing this work. And look, I mean, like even for those folks who listen to Undisclosed, you know, look at what's happened in Philadelphia, right? I mean, and look at many of the cases we've worked on. You know, a lot of these people are, a good number of these people are home now, and or there's been some progress in the courts. So justice requires vigilance, though. It's simple as that. It requires a lot of vigilance.
So I know that we got a lot of other questions, especially via tweet. But Robbie, I understand we're going to be addressing a lot of those very specifically in the next episode, right? So I don't want to like spoil that. Linda, I just want to, as we say goodbye to you, just ask you a question. I mean, you talked about working on this case for so many years and no one was listening and things weren't working. Do you feel like with Greg's case becoming a season of Undisclosed and with this team and their record, do you feel like somebody's listening now?
Absolutely. In fact, they're the only people who have listened to us, and we've been to all of the Innocence projects trying to get someone to take Greg's case, and no one would listen. So I can't say enough good about Rabia and the team and everything that they do. I know from my own experience, it takes a lot of work, a lot of time to work on one of these cases, and I just can't say enough good about them and what they're doing, that they are out there trying to help these people. And it, the devastation that these things bring to the families is so immense. It's just unbelievable, you know, that the cost of lawyers, investigators, everything that's involved here, it's really, really a hard thing to do, to overturn one of these things. So they're amazing. They're absolutely amazing.
Well, so are you, Linda.
Well, thank you.
I actually want to echo what you're saying. I mean, you know, Joyce is Greg's mother, and in many situations, even the families give up. They just don't have the stamina. Joyce has been an incredible advocate, and Linda has been an incredible advocate. I mean, there's only so much investigation I could do, because these two ladies over the last 15 years have done so much of it already. Even to the extent of, like, just Linda organizing files online for me. I mean, like, she's just done incredible work to reduce the amount of work that we've had to do then to work on the case. And so, Linda, I think you are just an amazing person. So thank you for allowing
us Rabia.
This case.
Thank you.
Well, thanks to everyone on the podcast, Rabia and Susan and Linda, for joining me to talk about this week's episode. It was a good one. And if for some reason somebody has listened to this much of the addendum and has not listened to episode 11, listen to it. Get other people to listen to it. Tell them this is the mic drop that Undisclosed is known for, and they need to give it a listen. So thanks, guys, for producing it and making my job so fun this week.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to the Undisclosed Addendum and the Greg Lance series. You can follow the show on social media at Undisclosed Pod, and you can ask questions for our future addendum episodes on Twitter and Facebook. Just use the hashtag UDAddendum. And remember, the sponsors of Undisclosed make it possible for this team to continue doing their great work. So support them, buy their stuff, and use the Undisclosed promo codes. The executive producer of Undisclosed is Methil Telhan. Audio production for The Addendum is by Hannah McCarthy. Our theme song is by Patrick Cortez. If you want to hear more of me, check out my true crime and pop culture review podcast, Crime Writers On, or listen to These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order and SVU podcast. Special thanks to my partner in crime and life, Kevin Flynn, for helping me get stuff done so I can host this series. Also thanks to Rabia, Susan, and Colin, who continue to make Undisclosed a great place to work, and for giving me part of their platform to host this series. I really appreciate it. On behalf of everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks.